We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
This is In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots podcast. It's all Pelicans, all the time.
And welcome to the podcast. The season is over, so we're here to bring you an assessment of all the players we're going to be able to draft at spot 52 in the drafts, because that's what we do when seasons end. We talk about the draft, right? Right, Michael? We have nothing else to talk about, right?
Yeah, how much we're going to sell our pick for and and what minimum free agent we could get. No, now we're actually talking about games one, future games in the second round. This is no injuries to report, so we don't have to do the segment sponsored by WebMD that we do every week. So, yeah, I don't know what to think.
Yeah, this is going to be a completely fresh podcast for everybody listening to it. No one will have ever heard anything like this in the history of In the Know. Like, seriously, I don't think I've ever had this much good news to talk about on a podcast. I'm just going to break down here in the corner and you just talk for a while.
I really think the best until now was that game four against the Lakers in our first year of In the Know, when Jarrett Jack hit that shot and the Hornets at the time, they tied it up 2-2. That was probably the and then that win against the Spurs that got the Pelicans into the playoffs against Golden State, I guess. Those were the two pinnacle moments until now.
Oh, a completely clean sweep. People are on Twitter giving people crap about how, you know, how kinds of pundits didn't pick the Pelicans. Like, I picked the Pelicans, but if you had feet to the fire been asked before the series started, what is the chance the Pelicans go 4-0? What percentage were you giving it?
I would have said 5-10, but I would have said there was a 0% chance the Portland would go 4-0. If you would have told me somebody sweeped and I had to bet my life on which one, I would have said the Pelicans without thinking. Although I picked Portland in 7, it was clear that the talent, especially the top end talent, was in the Pelicans' favor. It was just a matter of not having been there before and not knowing if certain guys could take their games to another level, but the ceiling for the Pelicans was always much higher than Portland. I think Portland is who they are. They could toggle between like 80 and 85. The Pelicans could be a 60 or they could be a 92. So if you would have told me there was a sweep, I would have said the Pelicans, but I would have said maybe 5% chance before the series started.
So, you know, if you'd asked me before the series started, I would have given them a greater chance if I knew that Dame Lillard was going to be injured all series like he was. Because clearly, that's what happened. He wasn't playing, right? I didn't see him out there. Did you see Dame Lillard out there?
I did. I mean, I don't want to take – see, one of my takeaways from the series is that I see a lot of people saying his Stotts in trouble, they need to blow it up, whatever. I don't think Portland played bad. Like, I wouldn't blow it up if I were them. Like, okay, people will say 4-0 and that the Pelicans were the most dominant team in the first round. Three of those games, if two possessions go differently, Portland could have won three of those games. People just look at the raw 4-0 sweep and think that Portland needs to blow it up or the Pelicans dominated. I saw them dominate in one game, and the other ones, you know, a couple possessions go a different way. Jrue Holiday doesn't make a block in game one, or, you know, a couple things go differently. I don't think they played that bad. I think Dame Lillard was basically swarmed everywhere he went and made the right plays as far as giving the ball up most of the time. I don't really take much away from them. I think they ran into the best player on the planet and a guy in Jrue Holiday who has never played that. I mean, they asked Terry Stotts after game two, you know, like, what did you prepare for coming into the series? He's like, we prepared for something, and then a totally different team than we had played this year showed up. And I really think that's the case. I think the Blazers ran into a team with a player playing at the top level. And then Jrue Holiday, like, he was playing like a top 5-7 player in the NBA. Plus, you had playoff Rondo and Mirotić going off at times. I don't take anything away from Portland. I actually thought they played a pretty good series, and I think it was closer than that 4-0 indicates.
Okay, there's a lot to unpack in what you just said, but I have to say this. You're really disappointing me, man. Like, I have a chance to gloat about Portland completely bombing a series, and I feed you a Dame Lillard, who's his daddy kind of thing, and you just give me that. You give me a reasonable evaluation of the series. Now, like, they all suck. Portland sucks. There isn't a player on that team that should be there next year. Blow it up. Think Keith Shabazz, because he's got a cool name.
Game one was 97-95, and we're talking about a Jrue Holiday, like, people will talk about the block, but the most amazing play he made was the Pelicans were up one, turned the ball over, and Portland has like a 3-on-2 fast break. McCollum went to make a pass, and Jrue Holiday just caught, blocked, stole it, like on a fast break.
Yeah.
And like game one was very losable. Game two could have gone either way. And even in game four, like, Portland hit shots and shots and shots, and it took top five NBA, like, both Davis and Jrue played like top five players in the entire NBA in that game just to finally pull away in the last minute. So people can make fun of Portland and say 4-0 and act like this was dominance. I saw one game that couldn't have gone either way. This two or three possessions are different. This could have been a 6 or 7 game series. So I'm not going to take much away from them. I hope they blow it up because I don't think they're going to do much better. But if I were them, I wouldn't.
Okay. Let me ask you this question then. It's obvious Davis was the MVP of the series. Well, maybe Jrue was. So one of those two. We'll come back to that.
You think they're the only two who you could put up for MVP?
Well, gun to your head, who is? So you obviously think there's a third one. Who is the third best Pelican in that series?
Oh, I could, if I had to, and honestly believe it, make a case for Davis, Holiday, or Rondo being the MVP of
wow,
that series.
You're that much on the Rondo train, huh?
So
okay, why? Why? What did Rondo do in that made you like think he,
so
he was equivalent of Davis and Holiday?
Did you see the minutes when Drew was the point guard and how like guys like Aminu and others just took the ball out of his hands like he was a little kid? Without Rondo, like they were good defensively, so they would win his stretches when he was out like 5-3 and stuff like that and stay ahead. He was orchestrating everything on the offensive end, and not just the assists, but getting guys in right positions. You talk to any player after the game, and how did you guys keep calm? Well, Rondo kept telling us, we're on the road, we're ahead, it's fine, keep cool, keep up. Like, I try to imagine if one of these players wasn't on the team, how would the series go? If Davis isn't here, they lose the series probably in 5 or 6. If Drew isn't on the team, they probably lose it in 6 or 7. And if Rondo's not there, I think they lose the series in 4 or 5 as well. Like, you're just talking about a guy who orchestrated the offense, who was very pesky defensively, got in Portland guys' heads, got technical fouls on them, and then every single time, like, what have we seen from New Orleans ever since you and I have done this podcast is when things start going wrong, they panic, they keep going wrong, it doesn't matter how many timeouts the coach takes, it just all kind of falls apart. You talk to any guy after any game, Rondo was telling us this, Rondo was doing that, Rondo was here. There are tangible reasons I could point to him for why he was the MVP of this series, but I just think when a guy takes everybody on the team and makes them better, like, did Anthony Davis make anybody else on the team better? I guess I could argue yes or no. Same with Drew Holiday. I know that Rajon Rondo calmed everybody down, focused everybody's mind, and then made them better. I think you've got to at least consider it for all of those reasons.
Wow. Okay. I don't think so. I'm going to just give you my case for AD, and everybody here is probably like rolling their eyes. Obviously, it's AD. It's such an easy thing to stake out. But for me, it's not even the scoring. And of course, AD being able to put up the points he does is great. But AD did on the defensive end of the floor everything you're giving Rondo credit for on the offensive end of the floor. Rondo made everybody able to score easily and quickly and get all the sets going and have that offense flow the way it did. If Davis wasn't running center field on that defensive line, like, Mirotić had moments, but Davis made that defense go. And if he wasn't behind all of those perimeter players who were fighting Lillard and fighting McCollum, that defense collapses in a second. It doesn't matter who you put in there. It's done. So he makes everybody better defensively just by his mere presence and ability to roam and ability to completely ignore Al-Farouq Aminu. I got to give him like all kinds of great grades for just how many times I giggled to myself where he started to run out, saw Aminu, and then kind of wandered off towards the nearest guard. Just like, forget that. It was brilliant.
Yeah. And actually, when I did my poll on Twitter, the winner was Drew Holiday. So we each have our picks, and at least my followers picked the third guy who – I mean, that's what's crazy about this series is I think, like, if Anthony Davis and Drew Holiday both played like they did in this series over the regular season, they'd both be in the top 5 in MVP voting, so they played that well. Rajon Rondo would probably shatter the NBA record for assists per game in a season. He was fantastic. And I think Mirotić played like, when you consider both ends of the court, like a borderline all-star type of player. Like, he had games where he was hitting his shots, but he was always rebounding. And he doesn't have Davis's athleticism at the rim, but he was very savvy, blocking shots, like contesting everything. I mean, I think we came into the series and remember me saying that there were four guys on the Pelicans I knew that were going to play good. I think I undersold them. I think they all played. I mean, this is it's definitely the best I've ever seen Drew play. Davis, it's up there. I mean, the Golden State series, he was amazing, and he's had stretches where he's been just like this. But I think Rondo and Mirotić played as well as I could have reasonably expected them to play. I think you had four guys who played at maybe an A to A plus level for what they're capable of. I thought they were all amazing. And then the other guy I would consider for MVP is Darren Erman. Because, you know, according to all reports, he watched every single game. He came up with a strategy. And then even before Portland adjusted their strategy for that, he then made minor tweaks to throw them off again. So I think he's another guy that should get a lot of credit in this series.
So I really regret one thing about one of these games. I should have stopped it and took a video of it. But there is – so generally when you watch on the TV, you're looking from the side of the court, and there's guys who are running around in front of the bench. You can't really get a good look necessarily at the coaches on the bench all the time. But there is one play – where the camera was doing, they sometimes do that weird angle from across the other court and you're watching from behind the play. And I don't particularly like that, but I loved it this time because I got to watch one full possession with Darren Erman on the bench. And I say that loosely because he's standing the entire defensive possession, stomping, pointing, leaping up and down, he was calling out every move that they should be making the entire defensive possession and freaking out if the guys weren't doing it quite as fast. I mean, if that's any example of what he is through the whole game, I don't know how his heart hasn't given out. It was one possession and he was losing it. And it wasn't even like end of game possession. It was like in the middle of the third quarter. It's crazy.
Yeah, I pray for his health that he doesn't become a head coach. I think it's perfect and be a defensive coordinator, get it, whatever. I think he'll be a 22-hour a day working type of guy. Plus, in games, he'll just be beyond stressed. But yeah, I think the work that he put in, and then obviously Gentry trusting him, was fantastic. So. Yeah, I mean, I think you give props to all of those guys. And all that said, like, those four guys, in my opinion, played probably the best basketball they could play. And again, three of the four games could have gone either way. And that's why I don't see the point of bashing on Portland or think that they've got to completely blow it up. I have personally never seen some of these guys play this good. And, you know, this is part of the reason why I get frustrated in the regular season. Like, I know you can't go all out for 82 games in the regular season, but it's not even just about the effort. It's about the intelligence. And now all of a sudden they have it in the postseason. And I'll be curious. I want you to think about this while I'm saying this. I want you to think about the three plays that you'll always remember from this series. And tell me about them after I finish this little ramble. But the one that sticks out to me is end of game four, game's close, and Drew Holiday drives hard at Nurkic, does not try to make the shot at all, just goes right into his body, draws the foul, and gets two free throws and fouls Nurkic out of the game. I've been calling for that for, what, 4 years, 5 years from Holiday? And he literally never does it, and now all of a sudden he does. Like, these are the things that I'm proud and I want to give him credit now, but the other part of me is like, well, the reason why I picked Portland in seven is because these guys literally never did this. And now all of a sudden they're doing it. Part of me is frustrated because they obviously had this in them and they wait till now to do it. And I hope that they continue to do it moving forward. But part of me just has to – I mean, I literally sat on the couch with my wife every single game, and she would turn to me and look at me and go, why doesn't Drew play like this all the time? And I had no answer for her. So as much as I enjoyed it, it kind of feels like – it's like when you see your ex get super hot and you just – you know, you wish she dressed like that, you know, while you were together. I just – Did that bother you at all? Because, again, I expect effort to go up in the playoffs. But a play like that we've been calling for years, and now all of a sudden they do it. Did you think about that at all, or are you just enjoying the playoffs for what they are?
I'll be honest. I'm just enjoying that. Like, I've got to say that Drew has been a crazy revelation all season long. If somebody came to you at the beginning of the season and somebody told you that Drew played like a bona fide all-star all season long, would you have thought that it was because he was driving to the basket every game aggressively and finishing around the rim over and over again? Because that's why Drew's at this level. I would have assumed it was because he started hitting his threes.
Yeah, I would have just assumed Davis and Boogie got him open shots and he knocked them down.
Yeah. I mean, his transformation this year from a guy who was perfectly happy to pull up and take that mid-range jumper or perfectly happy to pull up and take a step-back three all the time, to a guy who aggressively gets all the way to the basket and relishes finishing with the left hand around people, and that's even before this game where he went through Nurkic, like, that is a significant, impressive transformation. I can't remember seeing a guard do. Usually, as they get older, they start to fade further and further away. And he's just doing the opposite. He's going right to the rack. And it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, so I asked you to think about it. What are the three plays that 3 to 5 years from now, you'll think about this series and remember those plays?
So I have two plays and then one just thing I want to talk about. The very first one is there's a I forget which game it's in. I think it's two. Might be three. Yeah, I think it's beginning of three, where Etuan Moore gets into a jump ball situation and he steals the jump and he knocks it to Rondo. And Rondo looks up court and just whips it all the way up court to a streaking Jrue Holiday for a layup. And I just felt like that was like the perfect encapsulation of what this team has done over the last like 2 to 3 months. Is just how many times this season did we say, why is he making that touchdown pass? Why is he throwing the ball way up there and getting these turnovers? Well, the reason they do that in game is so that they can complete them in situations like this. They're getting better and better at them as they execute them. And so still sometimes it might result in a turnover, but like, that was just, I don't remember how many times all of that happens where somebody not only steals the jump ball, but as soon as it happens, the guards are already sprinting down court to get open. Like, most people are waiting to see, do I need any scrum? Do I need to get defensive? I'll move back slowly, or they assume they're going to set the defense. Like, no, they were just, it's ours, I'm gone, and he's down court. And then the second one, and there's caveats about this because it's not as important as some people make it out to be. The Trailblazers were down three when this happened. But Jrue Holiday's block of Connaughton, like, even though it wasn't as impressive as some of the other defensive plays, it's just so iconic and awesome. It was a perfect encapsulation of Jrue just shutting down so many people of different heights and speeds and sizes that I absolutely love that. That was number two. Number three, and this one is more of just a general thing. Can you remember any pair of teammates that haven't played together for like two, three, four seasons that seem to be connected as well as Davis and Rondo when Davis is spinning for that lob off of a mid post.
No, I mean, there's a couple of times on a pick and roll where Rondo will assume he's popping and Davis will roll, but I mean, most times they're right on the same page. And yeah, they've played together, what, 65 games or so?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, you could just imagine if they, you know, get another training camp together and, they could be an amazing tandem.
And I find that, like, so crazy because, like, there are teammates who play together for years, Durant and Westbrook, Wall and Beal, like, that, you know, have all the talent, and some of them are talented passers, and they never feel like they're on the same page like these two do after just, you know, most of a season. I remember when I used to watch the Bulls back in the 90s, there was moments where Pippen and Jordan felt like this. They would play off of each other so well, but they had been playing together for, you know, 7 years at that point. So it's just one of those things. I mean, the number of times where you just saw Davis post spin immediately and just catch that ball, the ball's already in flight as Davis starts his move. It's just amazing. I love every minute of it. And then there's two times where Portland actually tried to do the same things where Aminu once and Ed Davis once posted up Mirotić and then tried to spin and go to the basket. And both times the guards just even failed to notice that they had done the spin. Didn't throw a lob at all. And it just makes me cackle. Like, I'm like, you're not even on the same level, dudes. Screw you, Portland. I got to throw that in there.
Again, Davis, I could pick any number of highlight dunks. I mean, I think I'll always remember the play where he flushed the Ian Clark miss and then Drew Holiday pointed at Nurkic.
I can't even believe I didn't bring that one up. That's...
Yeah, I think I'll always remember that. But the two plays that made me get off my couch was, I believe it was game two, Rondo threaded the needle with a pass through the lane. Now, I say I'll remember it for 5 years, and I can't even remember who finished it. It was either Holiday or Moore. But it was this past, like, it was a pass where I don't think anybody else in the NBA could have made that pass. And it was just, when you see something, when you watch hundreds of hours of basketball games a year, and then you see something that you literally never see anywhere else, it just jars you. And it was a pass that I watch all these different teams, all these different games, nobody else in the NBA makes. And it's just at that point you go, you know, Rondo, for all his flaws, is just a different dude. There is nobody else like him in the NBA right now. And then the other one was the one where Rondo basically drives baseline and the two Portland defenders go with him. But before he even knew that, he does the behind-the-back pass to AD for the flush, and it's like, when you see something that you don't see anywhere else, it stays in your mind. And Rondo had those two plays in the series that, you know, we often say on this podcast, you know, are we judging point guards too harshly because, you know, we still have the ghost of Chris Paul over the franchise, and we're comparing people to him. Chris Paul, still my favorite player of all time. He doesn't make either of those passes. Rondo's just on an even another level as a passer and the way he sees the game. And I think those are the three plays that I remember 5 years from now.
Yeah, so you're an aficionado of passing porn. I gotcha. It's kind of like, the only other guy in the league right now who I think ever did that kind of passing, Ginobili could pull those things off. And that was one of my big jealousies of the Spurs, was watching those highlights of Ginobili nutmegging people or, you know, just whipping these passes between four people to get to a guy you didn't even know was open.
Yeah. To me, it's not just the passing. It's I could see them playing chess in their mind, and they're so far ahead of everybody else on the court. Like I've experienced that when I, you know, I've had moments, and then especially when you play with people of different talents, or you could talk about other games or other things we're all good at, but you could just tell that Rondo sees the game in a different way than other people do. So yeah, and then that the Davis dunk, and I didn't see the Jrue Holiday point in real time. But then after that was added to it, that just became a play for me I'll never forget. But yeah, those are my three plays I'll remember from this series. So
Nurkic, like I didn't see a lot of the. I mean, I'm not there. I don't hear. I obviously can't hear the good jawing going on the court. Like Jrue was as fired up in these four games that I've seen his entire career. Like there's that game in Portland where he was over and over again. It wasn't just like two or three possessions. Like he was drawing at this guy in the second row behind Portland's, like near Portland's basket, that he just was going back to him. And every time he had a good play, he would go and look at the guy or he'd shout something at him. Like somebody had him on fire hot. And then like, he's just pointed in Nurkic's face. Like he like must have legit disdained Nurkic for something in this series that I didn't see. Like it was just so disrespectful.
Yeah, I think the Pelicans as a team were tired of how much Nurkic complained. And you know, Nurkic probably had some gripes. I thought there were some plays where he got fouled, or he got like hit in the face on a swing through and then he would get called for the foul. So he had some legit, but also Anthony Davis is being held on every single play. Like just play through it, buddy. So when you hear a guy whining all game, you hear fans booing at every non-call or call that goes against their team. And then Anthony Davis has a moment like that. Like, yeah, you just point in the guy's face and laugh. I totally get it. But, yeah, I mean, even attitude-wise, Jrue was a different guy. Like, we could mock all of these people, myself included, who picked the Blazers, but Jrue Holiday was a different human being in this series. And even if he was just, you know, as good as we'd ever seen him before, the Pelicans could have lost the series. Like, if you take the best Jrue ever prior to the series, like, that guy probably wouldn't have been good enough to win games 1, 2, and 4. So we're talking about a real series. We didn't see the best Jrue. I mean, we saw 20% better than Jrue Holiday had ever been in any game at any point in his entire life. So I don't know how you're supposed to predict something when a guy becomes 20% better than he's ever been at any time in his life, but I'm glad he chose to for this series.
Yeah. Yeah, did you catch any of the interviews of Davis, Rondo, and Jrue after game 4?
Yeah.
And like they kept asking questions and Jrue and Davis pick up their microphones and put them next to Rondo so he could answer. Oh, I enjoyed this series so much. And just being Portland just makes it that much sweeter. I hope they have so much chaos.
It was a good series. That that being said, we did say that this was by far the best matchup for a lot of players on the Pelicans. I mean, how much do you think it was the matchup versus Portland versus, you know, as opposed to the Pelicans would have played this good against any of the, like, if let's say they lose on that last night, are they giving Houston a series? Or if Utah had gotten the 3 seed instead of Portland, are they playing this well and beating Utah? Like, how much of it was the Pelicans just stepped up and would have done so against any opponent? And how much was it they really got the perfect opponent in round one for them?
So considering what we saw Jrue do and the obvious team preparation and how well we saw Mirotić play, I think that we would have seen a much better shot against Utah or Houston if they'd been playing those teams. I think, though, I felt like their confidence just grew and grew. Like, they played that first game, and they looked like they just they got confident, then got overconfident in the first game, and that's why Portland came rolling back and almost took it back, and they took the fact that they, you know, righted the ship and won it, and they carried that confidence in the second game and got even more crazy. And by the third and fourth, it legitimately felt like the Pelicans walked out there, and every single one of them thought they were better than the guy they were matching up against. Like, they're just like, I'm going to own you tonight. So I didn't know if that happens if you play against the other teams and they have completely different matchups that make you unable to execute the way they did against Portland. Like, it's a different thing when you're leaving Joe Ingles wide open on the perimeter instead of, you know, Al-Farouq Aminu. And, you know, all credit to Aminu. He did everything he could in this series with what Sewell said he had. It was the absolute worst thing that Portland could have as a guy weak at that particular location on the floor. So, I don't know. I'm really looking forward to see this Golden State series, to see how this confidence and aggression plays out. Because I think that'll answer a little bit of our questions about whether or not this was just a really beneficial matchup, or if they're actually elevating their game to a new level. So, what do you think? What's your take on it?
I think it's a combination. I think whoever they would have played, they would have came out with more effort and energy than we had seen. I think Rondo would have been more focused. But I think that game one gave them a lot of confidence. Like, to your point, they go out and they barely hold on to win game one. They almost choke that one away. And then they go, hey, we won a road playoff game. And then game two, they come out a little bit more confident. And by game three, they just think that they have the four best players on the court, and they're just storming Portland and have all the confidence in the world. Now, they lose that last game of the regular season, and they get Houston in round one, and they lose game one close and then get blown out in game two. I don't know if those things ever form. So it's tricky for me. I think, you know, I think that they definitely played better, and we've seen another level. I also think, like I thought before the series, they got the absolute perfect opponent for them. And, yeah, we're gonna see in this next round, with starting it off at Golden State, even, you know, without Curry, you're dealing with a lot of length. You're dealing with guys who, you know, they have multiple Rondos on their team because they have multiple guys who have been to multiple finals, and, you know, they have all that experience there. So, yeah, we'll know shortly, you know, which Drew is the real Drew, and how much of that one that we get. But I'm going to give them a lot of credit, but I'm not going to be a true believer until I see these first three games or so of the Golden State series.
Okay. I have two more questions for you about the Portland series before we maybe start talking about Golden State and matchups. First one, can be either team. Who do you feel most sorry for after that series?
I would say DeMarcus Cousins.
Okay.
Just because, like, this team could have really been a contender. He really could have gotten to the playoffs for the first time and been a part of something special. And it's awesome that he got to go to the game in New Orleans, and, you know, more than just the game itself, got to see DJ Manny Fresh perform. But yeah, I mean, just the fact that he knew he could have been a part of this, and you've got to kind of sit there on the bench and watch. I feel a little bad for him.
Okay. Yeah, I don't feel sorry for any of the Portland players. Screw those guys.
Oh, what about Terry Scott?
No, don't feel sorry. He coaches for Portland. No. If I had to put on my compassion thing, I actually think that Nurkic is going to end up unfairly maligned for this series. Because I think he is actually a legitimate starting center in the NBA. I think he's better than probably 2/3 of the starting centers in the NBA right now. And he just ended up, A, not being really all that trusted by his own coach, even though I felt he was their second most effective offensive player for most of these games. When he also just happens to match up against Mirotić and Davis, who are his particular kryptonite. There's just nothing you're going to be able to do against that pair of front court players if you're Nurkic. So I think that he's supposed to be a restricted free agent this summer. I wouldn't be surprised at all if this particular bad taste in people's mouth after the series and the fact that center market is pretty jam-packed with players anyways, if he doesn't lose a significant amount of money on his next contract.
I was scared of him when he was on the court. Like, I loved when he wasn't on the court. So, I just would have put him on Mirotić if I'm Portland. Now, I know people are like, well, now he's got to chase Mirotić all over screens and all whatever. Okay. So, Mirotić score 30 on me if he can, because I can't get out to him. Like, I'll live with that. I don't know why they didn't at least try that more. I like Nurkic. It kind of reminds me of Tiago Splitter against the Heat. Like, Tiago Splitter that year for the Spurs was huge. He was fantastic in the first three rounds, and then up against the Heat, like, they played him off the court, and he looked like a freaking schlub. And it's like, guys are just going to have matchups like that. But, you know, if Portland would have played Utah in round one, he would have been – I mean, I watched it the last game of the season. Nurkic vastly outplayed Gobert and was the reason Portland won that game.
Gobert's a top 10 player in the NBA. There's maybe better than Anthony Davis, so yeah. That can't be true.
But I mean, you're right. If Portland gets Utah in the first round, Nurkic probably gets a huge contract, but instead he runs into, you know, a freak of nature that would have embarrassed anybody. I mean, Anthony Davis embarrassed Draymond Green in the playoffs, and Draymond Green is consensus defensive player of the year candidate and winner. So, I could see why you feel a little bad for Nurkic.
Yeah, he's the only one. Like, because honestly, like, there's people who are blaming Dame. There are people who are blaming CJ. Evan Turner is getting killed, but Evan Turner always gets killed. I think that's just his role in life, is to be overpaid and over tortured for his deficiencies. But what's the worst thing that can happen to CJ or Dame? Like, the front office decides I need to cut ties with that guy, and CJ is going to end up in a great situation where he's going to just do what he always does. So whatever, like, he'll be fine. Nurkic is going to lose money as a result of this. That's the only reason why I'm picking him. Mm. And, you know, if Stotts gets fired, already Orlando wants to hire him. So.
Then I'll really feel sorry for him.
That's true. I guess I should feel sorry for Stotts if he's the obvious heir to the Orlando throne. Did you see the thing that Orlando tweeted out today about their assist leader?
Like 3-point is Shelvin Mack or something.
It was 3.8 season leader in assists, and shows Shelvin Mack, and at the bottom it says 3.9 assists.
Yeah.
Who makes that decision? Like, are you just like trolling your own team at that point? He just like they're just getting roasted all day.
Yeah, Magic basketball, catch the fever.
Okay, so anything else you want to talk about Portland before we happily move on to a game that maybe is you know, Saturday could be the first one if they manage to, you know, finally beat the, you know, 7 seed. Like, come on, Spurs. Like, come on, Gold State. You can't beat the second seed or 7 seed.
The only other thing I got is, like, different people and, you know, hardwood paroxysm, whatever. Just a couple of people tweeting how well Al-Farouq Aminu played in this series.
I thought he was their best player in Game 3.
No, he wasn't. Like, I could go find 10 guys at the Y right now that, if you do not cover, could score 20 points in a game. Like, no, just because the stats say that you put up this many points and you, like, he was literally, like, they literally treated him like when I have to bring my wife onto the court because we only got 9 to run and she has to play and just fills one of the spots. Like, they treated him like that. Like, they didn't even cover, like, you can't say a guy played well if the team literally gives you any shot you want and are playing 10 to 20 feet off you. Like, so he averaged 19 points per 36 and 10 rebounds, and you could tell me all these stats. The games I actually watch with my eyes, like, nobody is near him. I just can't give somebody credit and say that they played well just because the stats say they did when nobody is within 10 to 15 feet of you. So I don't know. I don't know why that bothered me, but it just, here when I hear people say that he played well, I can't wrap my mind around that.
Yeah, I only said that because in the third quarter of that game when they were just getting torched, the only guy on Portland who looked like he was still fighting defensively and fighting for rebounds was Aminu. It looked like he still gave a crap, and the rest of that team had just been like, all right, we're done. So, but you're right. Like, absolutely. Like, it is. It's embarrassing. Like, you go back and watch that, and like I said before, Davis would literally turn, see it was Aminu at the ball, and then go double cover a guard somewhere else.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, like, you put Harkless in his spot, and all of a sudden the Pelicans couldn't have done the things that they did on defense. So anyway, I can't get on the Aminu love train, and he was so good. Like, he was making his shots, but I felt embarrassed for him. The fact that you would cover an NBA player the way that they did, but it was the right move by the Pelicans, but I can't now join this bandwagon of, well, Aminu played really good. That's a guy they should keep. No, like, McCollum and Lillard didn't have good stats because every single thing was focused on them. Aminu didn't play better than them. Aminu was playing 1-on-0 while they were playing 1-on-3. So, anyway, that's all I got on that series.
Yeah. What did you think about Moore? We didn't mention the fifth starter.
Per usual, I thought he played better in Hall. I mean, he was obviously good in Game 2. But I just, other people are going to have to do things for him. Portland took away that little loop screen that he likes to run and curl action with the floater. And, you know, he could get some open looks, and in some games he drilled them. I thought defensively, I think McCollum is a really good matchup for him. Like, I don't like Moore against, obviously, like, the little quick squirt bug type of guards. And then, obviously, against bigger.
Did you say squirt bug?
Definitely a squirt bug. and then, obviously, against bigger guys when he's playing the threes, not good. This was, again, in so many ways, this was the perfect team for the Pelicans because Moore basically had his choice of two combo guards. Neither guy incredibly quick and neither guy tall. Like, that's the exact perfect guy for Etuan Moore to cover. You put him on Steph Curry, he's dead because Curry is going to dribble up and around him. You put him on Klay Thompson and Klay Thompson's going to shoot over him. Like, these were the exact type of guys you want more trying to defend.
Yeah. Okay. So. Cool. Ready to talk some Golden State?
Let's do it.
All right. They're going to play the Golden State Warriors, and they're going to win in three games. So, yeah. Anyways, they're supposed to start Saturday. Steph Curry,
Let's talk Golden State without Steph and Golden State with Steph.
Okay.
So which one do you want to talk first?
So, I don't think anybody really has any firm grasp on when Steph's coming back. I have a feeling he will come back in the series. And I think, like, if they lose one game, the first game, then he'll come back faster. And I think if they win the first game, then maybe, depending on how it goes, he might stay out longer. But without Steph, I think the game actually morphs fairly dramatically. I think that they can treat Portland in much the same way, not Portland, Golden State, the much the same way they treated Portland defensively. And that's, they can just play off of whoever has Draymond Green. They're going to be able to play off of him, let them roam. If he wants the three-point shot, take it. He will be more dangerous than Aminu ever was, because Draymond Green is capable of sometimes hitting those shots, but not any better than Aminu, but he can also start driving and kicking, and that makes a major difference, because if the guy can move, you then have to start paying attention to him as he goes to the basket and collapse on him, which then means one of the bazillion dangerous shooters on that team will then be open. But I still think that that helps you be able to help off of Draymond Green and have, you know, since Steph's not out there, one less shooter that you've got to absolutely 100% respect and worry about him back screening you and getting Green open more often. So I think that's a major difference. I still think that Kevin Durant is going to be absolutely insane in whatever series we go against him. Like, would it shock you at all if he averaged 35 points a game against the Pelicans?
No, and the more I'm thinking about this series, I would actually encourage him to. Okay. I really think, so again, I think you could talk me into the Pelicans winning a series against Golden State if Curry doesn't play at all. So just talking about the Curry-less Golden State Warriors, my strategy would honestly be the Durant could get 35 to 40 strategy, and let me just clamp down the other guys, which I really feel like I could do. I feel like I could put Drew on Clay, chasing him around all the screens, getting up in his junk all game. I could shut him down. Draymond Green, I'm not worried about offensively at all. So really, if I just let Durant go crazy, who else am I terrified of, or, you know, really thinking could hurt me? So the Curry-less Warriors, I think Durant would go off, but I would kind of let him. I would love for them to break all their actions and ball and whatever and just go to Kevin Durant elbow ISOs. I've seen how that ends for Durant in the playoffs, and I would actually kind of lean that way.
Yeah, I mean, so you're right. The thing that's always made Golden State super dangerous is the ability to move the ball, and the fact that Steph Curry and Klay Thompson were always perfectly willing to run up behind anybody of any size and set a back pick while the other guy sprints the other direction to get open shots. And most guards don't usually do that kind of thing, or at least do it effectively. And since when Steph Curry does it, you know, he'll set the pick and then he sprints to the wing, and now you're suddenly having to make a decision on the fly. Do I chase him back out to the three-point line where he's going, or do I try to follow the guy who he set the screen for? And you're in a really nasty, gnarly situation because he only needs about a half second of space. Clay is similar, so I don't know if Drew's going to be able to stick to him all the time. I have a feeling that Clay and the Golden State Warriors team are capable of springing him open for some shots, because I feel like Drew is better shutting somebody down when they are trying to actually dribble the ball in his vicinity. And if Clay's just catching and shooting, I don't think he's actually going to be as effective. The interesting thing, though, that we saw at the end of the season was when we played Golden State near the end, Drew was guarding Kevin Durant. So, A, did you think that was effective? And B, would you do it? Would you do it sometimes? Would you not bother and just let Solomon Hill or you know, Mirotic or even Davis take their lumps against him? What are you thinking about? What defensive lineups are you showing him?
Yeah, I think you put different guys on him just to make his life tough, and so he's got to change what he does throughout the game. But no, I know what you're saying about Drew being better on ball, but I also think he sticks with guys through screens better than anybody else. And you could hedge off-ball screens the same way that you could hedge, you know, a guy on the ball. You know, the guy who's setting the screen on Drew that Clay's coming off of, well, he's got a guy defending him. He could just kind of step up and block that pass from happening while Drew makes sure that the other guy doesn't slip. And there's ways to do that in the same way that the Pelicans could be aggressive like they were against Portland on the ball. They could be off the ball with Clay. My strategy would be I'd have, you know, more Hill, even Rondo times on Durant, AD to give them different look, whatever. But my overall strategy in the series would be I would say to myself, okay, if I really limit Clay, if I, you know, if all of a sudden he's scoring 17 points on 14 shots in this series, and then I take out the little role players and make sure that Nick Young never gets off, make sure that Quinn Cook isn't getting wide open looks. Like, how many points per game would Kevin Durant have to average? Again, assuming no Steph Curry, how many points would Kevin Durant have to average to beat me? And I really think the number would have to be like between 39 and 45. I really think Durant would just have to have an all-time series, which he could. But my focus would be how do I shut down the other guys? And then if Durant's hitting those elbow jumpers, and if he's rising over guys for three, and he's putting up all those points, then good for him. But my focus would actually be on the other guys.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I can see where you're going with that. Like, the thing is, what Golden State's going to be doing is they're going to be hunting our weakest defenders. And I'm sure they're going to actually think for a little while that Mirotic might be the weakest defender on the floor. And I think they'll find out pretty quickly he puts up enough resistance that it's not actually profitable to be going at him. But I would be 100% expecting that we'll see some, you know, Durant guard pick and rolls to try to get Etuan Moore or whoever's got Etuan Moore or whoever's got Rajon Rondo defending Durant. And your game plan would be like, sure, let them do that. We'll worry about the other guys and, you know, we'll leave them on an island. Or would you send help periodically, or just what are you thinking?
I send help once he gets below the free throw line. Okay. But if he wants to rise over Rondo and take 16 footers all series, which again, he's going to make a lot because he's tremendous and he's long, and that's, you know, that's fine. But you look at that game that the Pelicans won against them towards the end of the season, Durant had 41. I was fine with that. The thing that bothered me in that game was leaving Quinn Cook, and Quinn Cook has 21 points. Like, if you would have limited that, then Golden State's not even in that game. So, right. To me, it's those guys. Like, I wouldn't say it's pointless to make Durant's life harder and to try to limit him, but that is so much more difficult. And then by trying to do that, you could fail at everything. If I let Durant go off and just say and accept that he's going to average 40, like, let's just say I say to you, no matter what you do, Durant's going to average 40 a game in the series. then you say your solution would be, okay, well, then I got to make sure that its supporting cast doesn't do anything. And I just think that's so much better of a strategy than trying to take away a little from Durant and then hoping that you could also quiet all of the role players. I know if I focus on Quinn Cook or Draymond Green and Nick Young and Iguodala and even Clay to some extent, I know that if I make them the defensive focus, I can make them just as, you know, inefficient as I made the Portland guys last series. I don't know that if I do whatever I try to do against Durant that I'm going to limit him at all. So why don't I just take away the things I know I can take away?
Okay. One more question before I think we switch to the Steph being there that I had for you. Actually, I got two more. One is one of the most dangerous things about Golden State typically has been they go small and they run you out of the building. Their transition game, they are always top of the league the past year, 3 years of number of points they got in transition. They're just really efficient at getting out in the break after getting a steal and just scoring it or ramming the ball down your throat before you can do anything. With Steph not out there, though, are they still a dangerous transition team, or do you think they're less dangerous? Do you think it doesn't matter because they still got Iggy and Durant and Draymond Green and all those guys who know how to score on you? Are you worried about being a fast-paced team and them being a transition mastery team in general?
I think they go from 100 in transition to like a 65 without Curry. I think that's the biggest place where they miss him, just because, you know, that Steph Curry, to me, the only players I've ever seen like this are Steph Curry and Kyle Korver in his prime, where in transition, defenders will run out to those guys beyond the arc before they even worried about covering a guy who's going straight for the rim. I think Curry opens all of that for them in transition. They're still good in transition in a different way, just the fact that they have multiple ball handlers and, yeah, they have a guy like Clay who could sprint out to the three-point line, and Durant's very dangerous in finishing all the way at the hoop. But without Steph, they go from maybe the best transition team of all time to above average.
Okay. Yeah, I kind of agree with that. Like, that's always been my, like, just think about any Pelican game against this Golden State Warrior team, Durant or before Durant, and the moments other than Steph Curry hitting that crazy shot in the corner, the things you remember is them, like, Steph Curry pulling up 6 feet behind the line in transition and just drilling it. And there's nothing you can do against that. It's unstoppable. So without him there, Durant has his spots in transition that he'll run to and be pretty good at hitting him, but you know he's running to those spots. Steph Curry could do it from anywhere. It didn't matter to him. So
if without Steph, what would you guess their starting five is and their finishing five?
So they've been rolling with McGee, and I expect that will continue, at least until they need Zaza to come out and break someone's ankle.
How about the other guard spot? Quinn Cook or Iguodala?
No, Quinn Cook will start. Iguodala will play a lot of minutes. Especially if Drew starts rolling, they're going to deploy the Iguodala Clay Draymond Green perimeter, and that'll make, you know, Rondo and Drew's life a lot harder. It doesn't matter how savvy and awesome and focused they are. Getting past that much length and then running into, you know, Durant, who's actually a very nice help defender when he's actually thinking about it, and whatever center of the day might be, they have a pretty good chance of stopping people.
So you think they'd start Cook and McGee, and then how about who's finishing the game with the obvious three?
So it would be probably Draymond, West, Iguodala, Clay, and Durant.
Mm.
Unless okay. Quinn Cook is burying us, then he might be out there to shoot.
Yeah, that That team wouldn't scare me all that much.
Is West the person that doesn't scare you?
Yeah, I don't think they would go with West and Green. I think my guess would be that they either go... So I think they play Draymond and Durant at the 4 and 5. Okay. Then you would have Clay, and then I think you're going with... Well, you're obviously going to go with Iguodala, and then I think the other guy would more likely to be Cook or Young. I think they would go small, more shooting. I think that would be who they would finish with. I think they finish games with Durant and Green at the 4 and 5 for sure. So, yeah, I think that's interesting. I do think that they'll start Iguodala like they did against San Antonio, but we'll see. Maybe Cook makes some sense as well with Rondo being on the court. But I think if you tell me Curry doesn't play the whole series, I think this is a 6 or 7 game series. I really think that's a series which New Orleans could compete with Golden State. And I think AD could go off. I think that Drew will have obvious, I mean, I don't think no matter who he plays, he'll have a worse series than he did against Portland, but I think that he'll have some games where, he'll be severely limited on the offensive end. The guy that I'm most curious about is Mirotić. Looking back at some old games where Mirotić played against the Warriors, he actually did quite well. Now, those games were blowouts, and we know the Warriors kind of mess around, you know, against bad teams. But even in that last game that New Orleans went there and won before the end of the season, Mirotić was cutting a lot. He was, you know, he got himself easy looks early, and then later in the game he was just burying threes. He finished with 28 points on 18 shots. So, yeah, he played absolutely tremendous. I mean, the whole starting lineup did, and that's the thing, is like that game was close and down to the wire. You look at the box score, and the starting lineup for the Pelicans played unbelievable. I mean, Etuan Moore scores 15 points on 7 shots, goes a perfect 7 for 7. Rondo has 17 assists. Drew Holiday with 25, Mirotić with 28, AD with 34, and they just barely won a game against a Golden State team who was, you know, playing probably the worst stretch of their season. So, the Pelicans do not have a huge margin of error, obviously, in this series.
All right, so Steph Curry comes back. And again... Yeah. So we can't assume that it's going to be peak Steph coming back. Like he's injured, right. and everything that you get, the feeling you get is when he comes back, he's still not going to be fully healed. They're not waiting all that time. So, like, do they have a prayer if Steph is out there, or do you think it's just done?
I mean, it's not an insult to the Pelicans. This is. One of the greatest teams of all time when Steph is there. You could argue that you have 3 of the 4 or 5 best shooters in the entire NBA and maybe 3 of the 10 best shooters in NBA history all on the same team in an era where shooting is more important than ever. I mean, the answer is no, the Pelicans wouldn't have a shot to win the series, but I don't think that's insulting at all when you consider what that team has. So now we could start talking percentages. With 60% Steph Curry, the Pelicans could take it to 6, maybe even 7. 80% Steph Curry, you could win a game, maybe 2. 100% Steph Curry, I think the most common way it would play out would be Warriors in 5.
Okay.
But we're not going to get 100% Steph Curry. I mean, you know, there's a chance he misses a game or multiple games. But I don't think, you know, I think Pelicans fans are on a bigger high than ever right now. I don't think that if Steph comes back and the Warriors lay the smackdown that, you know, any of that should be taken away. Like, you're playing the 96 Bulls. You're playing, like, the one of the greatest teams of all time, and you're missing an all-star starter. You're not going to win that series, and that's nothing to be ashamed of or now all of a sudden take away from the last series we just had.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so Steph Curry, say he misses games 1 and 2. Pelicans manage to split that. So it now becomes a 5-game series. Steph Curry comes back, and he's, you know, operating about 80-85%. You think that because now it's a 5-game series and you have a little bit more, you know, chance that luck is going to go your way, what odds do you think that the Pelicans would have of pulling out an upset if that was the scenario?
5% or less.
Wow. Okay.
Because, right. Like, Ryan, what you have to remember is, okay, let's say you even get to 3 wins in the series. Now you've got to, and I don't care where the game is, at home, on the road, whatever, now you've got to go beat the defending champion, one of the greatest teams of all time, in a 4th game in that series. Like, do you know how good you have to be to beat, to eliminate one of the greatest? Like, I remember watching Jordan, even when he was, you know, getting past his prime, and I'll never forget in his last season, like, people all talk about Utah, Indiana had them beat. Like, it was done. And in game 7, Indiana was up. The game, I thought, was over. And Michael Jordan just, he didn't let it happen. And they won. And you don't just win that 4th game against a champion. So, like, even if everything breaks right, even if the Pelicans are up 3-2 at home against New Orleans, like, beating a championship team with that might have the best starting lineup of all time, and, like I said, 3 of the best shooters in the time, like, remember the Thunder? Remember the Thunder just a couple of years ago? Like,
they
had Golden State on the ropes, and then Klay just goes insane. Like, I don't think people really realize how hard it is to get that 4th win. And I just can't see, if Golden State's season is on the line, that the Pelicans, I don't care where the game is played, get a 4th win against a healthy Golden State team. So I can't see a series win barring a Stephen Curry never coming back and or Kevin Durant getting seriously hurt, and all of us sending our fake prayers out on Twitter when it happens. So, I just couldn't see it barring those things happening.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with you. I was just going to make you say it instead of me.
And again, I hope people realize that's fine, and I think we can have a conversation about who would be the favorite in this series if Boogie had never gotten hurt, and is there a path for next year or years beyond for the Pelicans being better than the Warriors? Because I think if you would have posed that question 18 to 20 months ago, like, really think about it. Like, the Warriors get Durant. They look like a juggernaut. And if you would have came to me and said, you know, the Pelicans by the 2019 or by the 2018-19 season could be better than Golden State, I would have thought that the Golden State charter plane blew up or something. But I do think there is now a path for the Pelicans next year, the year after, to be better than Golden State. And that's got to be pretty exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It gives all kinds of options and things that could happen this summer or even next summer, which we're not going to talk about now because that's getting ahead of ourselves.
When do we ever do that?
No, we don't get ahead of ourselves ever. Okay, so I already kind of, you know, said this, but let's say the Pelicans are up in game one, and they're you know, because we've actually seen this story play out a lot with Golden State. They come out, they're all deadly serious. Golden State's just not quite all there, you know, on their in their focus yet. They get up, you know, at halftime by 14 points, and you know, you come out and it's the third quarter. And this time, because Davis and Drew have shown they've taken it to a new level, and they're actually maintaining that lead, even though, you know, Golden State is now focused. What is the odds that Zaza Pachulia enters the game at that point with very distinct instructions to do some damage?
I would say pretty high, and I would say I hope that he has been instructed to take out Solomon Hill.
I'm sure that'll be the target.
I will sacrifice Solomon to the Zaza gods.
All right, so let's say I came to you and said your plan is working, but Kevin Durant is having a series for the ages. You have one player, you have to deploy one player against him on this team right now. Who do you think you would deploy against Kevin Durant to try to slow him down just a little bit?
Man, this is going to sound like I am in love with this guy. It would be Rondo.
You're kidding me.
So, if you remember that game...
Oh, I just had my headset fall off. I'm laughing so hard. Okay, go ahead.
Do you remember the game where the Pelicans went in and...
Yeah,
and,
he got himself a steal at the end of it, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's a combination of things. One, it's the Steve Novak defense. I think Kevin Durant sees Rondo on him, and he loses all sight of team basketball, and he's just going to rise up and take mid-range jumpers, which... If I had to pick anything of all the things he does, and he's still great at, that's the shot I want him taking. I think Rondo, over the course of the series, in a Lance Stevenson type of way, would get in Durant's head, would bother him. Like, I think Durant is a pretty soft guy. I think he's pretty mentally weak. I think he's, you know, I think Rondo could absolutely exploit that more than anybody.
His burner accounts are going to tear you up tomorrow, dude.
Oh, I know, and they're going to like everything people say negative about Westbrook. But yeah, no, I don't think anybody's thought, like, again, to me, of course, Drew is the obvious answer in a vacuum, but I want Drew taking out Klay Thompson. I want him wrecking Nick Young and Quinn Cook's confidence before they even have a chance of getting started. Like, let Drew completely take somebody out as opposed to just slowing down somebody who's going to get theirs anyway. So with that in mind, you know, I like the idea of Rondo on him, and then you could blitz a second guy once Durant gets to a certain part of the court, and then play 4-on-3 defense, eventually leaving Iguodala or Draymond open, and if they hit, they hit. But that's my answer, and you could laugh at it and break your headset all you want. That's my answer, and I'm sticking to it.
Okay. No consideration of AD?
I mean, the issue with AD is you put him on Kevin Durant, and the best case scenario is that he makes Kevin Durant's shots harder and maybe slows him down 10-15%, but then you don't have him at the rim for other guys, and you don't have him swallowing up the board. So now you basically have Mirotić on the glass, and then a bunch of guys who don't rebound for shit. So I think you're trading off. I've thought through every scenario, and I see a bunch of strategies. To me, the one that just makes the most sense is I feel like you could shut down the boards. I feel like you could shut down other shooters. I feel like you could shut down penetration and other guys getting to the rim. And the sacrifice for that is that you put a guy like Moore or Rondo on Durant, and he probably goes crazy on them from mid-range, and that's it. So there's no perfect answer. That would be my answer.
Yeah. I thought about AD as possibly being like, if I need this guy to get a stop, I'm going to put AD on him. But I think Durant is probably one of the few players on the planet who I legitimately feel could get AD into foul trouble, like if AD is guarding them one-on-one. Like, I just feel like Durant has the length and the speed. Like, I guess maybe Harden could do it too, because Harden would flop into AD like a dying fish. But I think Durant would be capable of getting AD into foul trouble too. So that's the only reason why I'm not super keen on having AD guard him.
Yeah, you could talk to me about it in stretches, especially at the end of the game when KD's going ISO, stuff like that. Like, I would definitely do it in stretches. But, to me, the one thing I really wish, but I saw none of it in the last series, but then again, I've seen guys become much better overnight, shaving a beard, whatever. Solomon, if you could give me Solomon Hill from like March and April of last year and like teleport him into this series, I think he could do a lot of interesting things and present a lot of problems for Golden State and really be a useful tool. That Solomon Hill that I saw in the Portland series was the hottest pile of garbage I've seen on a basketball court. And unless he becomes the guy from a year ago, like, I just think he could be such a huge X factor in this series if we had that Solomon Hill. And it kind of upsets me that we have this Solomon Hill.
Yeah. He played 20 minutes in the third game against Portland, and that was the blowout. So clearly it was Solomon Hill.
He just, like, I've never seen a player do less. Like, it was
He's not that bad.
Oh, he's not that bad is a correct statement. He was that bad in the Portland series. Like, watch, you have your clips of Ehrman, whatever. Find other DVR, you know, if you haven't still DVR'd. And seriously, just check the game log, fast forward to the points where Solomon Hill goes on the court. Like, he literally runs to places and does nothing on both ends of the court. The ball goes up, doesn't even come close to getting a rebound. Like, it's hard for somebody to do less than he did. It almost was like a fan snuck on the court and was trying to not get discovered by security. He was invisible to the game. I've never seen a player be so useless, in so many ways. So anyway, I'm not saying he's a bad player, and he's had basically no practice, no training back camp, coming back from an injury. I'm sure every time he runs hard, he's terrified that he's going to tear his hamstring. Like, I know it. But because of that, he is playing like an absolutely worthless player. And that's just got to change for this series, because he's the exact – Solomon Hill at the end of last season is the exact kind of X factor that they need in this series.
Okay. I'm not going to argue with you about Hill.
Worthless.
All right, so we don't know what Curry's status or even when the game's going to start, but you got to lay your money down. What is your prediction? And we know how good your prediction was in the first round, so.
Hey, wait a minute. You predicted the right team, but let me remind you, I asked you, if the games come down to the end, I said specifically, let's say five games come down to the last minute, how many of those games does Portland win? And your answer was 4. So your whole way that the Pelicans were going to win that series was basically like we saw in game 3. So you didn't have the you didn't believe that the Pelicans could win close games that come down to the couple final possessions. So
I don't remember saying that, and you won't be able to find those episodes anymore anyways. So
a lot of us were wrong. I think that the Pelicans lose this one in 6. I think Golden State closes it out at New Orleans. But I do think that at least 3 of the losses will be close losses, similar to what Portland, felt against us. So to me, I would take that as a massive win. I think you've basically locked in Boogie coming back. And I think depending on how competitive you are in this series, you could get a lot of buzz around the NBA about your team and perhaps have another good summer coming up. So I'm gonna go with Warriors in 6. I think Steph comes back by game 2. I think the Pels win 1 in Golden State. I think they win 1 at home. I think it's 2-2 when it goes to Golden State, and then they'll win the final 2 games of the series.
Yeah, that's what I was going to pick, too, is Warriors in 6. I really, you don't know how badly I want to say, Warriors in 7, but I'm going to go Warriors in 6.
That's your dream.
My dream, is just stretch it to 7 games and make them go home and beat us.
Yeah. I think that's the most likely way to play. I think the only way to really come away from this series completely deflated is if it's a sweep and in 2 or 3 of those games it's a blowout. Yeah. I think you go and you win 1 or 2 games in this series and you're competitive in your losses, and it just makes AD even hungrier next year. The team sees what they have. Cousins comes back. You try and go recruit a couple other big fish this summer. I think that would be a great series for this team. And, yeah, extending it to 7 would be awesome.
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine how we would feel? Like, imagine it's 3-2 Golden State, and then New Orleans just comes back home and blows the pants off of them, like wins by 20.
Awesome.
And now all of a sudden it's 3-3, and we got 2 days to anticipate Game 7, and we're talking ourselves into, yeah, we figured it out. And we beat their ass, and it doesn't matter where this is. We like imagine
and then Gennaro Pargo appears on the court and misses a 3 at the end of it.
But imagine how exciting those 48 hours are before Game 7, and like that's the thing is, I hope fans remember when Kevin O'Connor goes on every Ringer show and talks about how blow it up if you're not winning a title, and the only thing that matters is titles. Like, I hope you just realize how much bullshit that is and remember how much fun you had and how excited you were between games 1 and 2 and, oh my God, we won game 1 and what if we could take game 2 also, and how excited you were after the sweep. And, like, if you lose to the Warriors in 7, that 48 hours before game 7 is going to be such an exciting time in your life. Just don't fall for this bullshit of all that matters is titles and calling teams like the Clippers the last 5 years disappointments. Like, their fans had a lot of fun, and that's all that this is entertainment. So anyway, that's my little rant on all of that and the Kevin O'Connors of the world.
Steph Curry has his ankles never come back. He tells in 6.
Oh, his ankles never come back. Yeah. All right. So we're both saying Golden State in 6.
That's okay. What we're saying.
That's Book fine. It. More home games. All that revenue, I'll take it.
Yep. So thanks, everybody, for listening to In the Know. And if the Pelicans pull off some early wins, we might have to have an emergency pod to talk about it. Let's hope for it, right?
We could hope.